there's a strategic reserve and China's paying for it. You know, that becomes more palatable to sell to other constituents if Trump puts tariffs on, of converting tariff dollars to Bitcoin that then go into the strategic reserve, where I could see the U.S. government having a strategic reserve and converting the debt, retiring the debt that it owes to Social Security in return for a finitely scarce asset. That will be when everybody else rushes in.
Do you think that there's a possibility that we could see the Fed either coming to a close here in the next 4 years or even in our lifetime?
I don't think that the Fed will ever be...
Bong, we are live here at Pleb Lab in Austin, Texas, with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where we've got the man, the myth, the legend, Parker Lewis, recent father. But before all that, Parker, you wrote the book Gradually Then Suddenly on Bitcoin. We're sitting here, we got the block clock in front of us, just at 99K. We're probably going to hit 100K in the next few days, or maybe even today. Is this the suddenly mark?
I get that question a lot. I think we're all going to know when it is. And so if we're still asking the question, it means no.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do you think is like going to be the next catalyst, right? Because we've got nation states, we've got, the U.S. including with that, building a Bitcoin strategic reserve. We've got traditional finance in it. We've got, money being dumped into Bitcoin that we've never seen before. So what do you think is going to take it to push it over the edge?
Well, I have a few heuristics to think about it, which is that when a couple things, when Bitcoin becomes the largest form of money in the world, then that will be when everybody else rushes in. And that doesn't necessarily mean 50% of people in the world. It might mean something like 5% or 10%, because the people who adopt it first will naturally have a combination of access to the greatest amount of information and knowledge, as well as the greatest amount of wealth to store. And so once there's a clear consensus that Bitcoin is the standard of value, then it will rapidly monetize. So I think that we still live in a world where fewer than 1 out of 100 people understand what's going on here. And that we probably need to be somewhere between 5 to 10%, maybe after this cycle, or maybe as part of this cycle that becomes clear. And then the other side of it, not to be cryptic, but I think that it will probably require a developed economy currency to hyperinflate to really induce the rapid monetization of Bitcoin. And those two things will likely be related to each other, not caused by Bitcoin, but
related to that. Then, there's a lot of talk about the U.S. debt, how it's just running out of control. A lot of people, famously say we're in a debt spiral. Do you see us like kind of going down that path? And how do you see the potential of a strategic reserve, I guess, affecting that? Would it be, a way to get out of it? Or is it the U.S. basically admitting that the dollar is basically, toast at this point?
I don't think that it's an acknowledgement that it's toast.
Okay.
I think that, my ultimate view is that in the end, the two cannot coexist, but that doesn't mean that they can't coexist for a long period of time. And it also doesn't mean that Bitcoin can't, or the U.S. government, the U.S. as a country, won't benefit from Bitcoin. Okay. And that it won't play a role. My view is that it will play a role in retiring debt and in recapitalizing the country from a treasury perspective, and ultimately recapitalizing an economy. So I think it's hard to think about in an aggregate, but thinking about it from the perspective of, take Social Security as an example. Social Security fund, I might be off slightly, but they own something like 2.6 trillion or 2.9 trillion in U.S. government treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
So what is backing Social Security Fund right now is a dollar-denominated asset that's purchasing less and less, and there's a gap there. I could see the U.S. government having a strategic reserve and converting the debt, retiring the debt that it owes to Social Security in return for a finitely scarce asset. And that would be both good for the U.S. government as well as good for retirees that have obligations owed by the Social Security Fund. So that's an example of how it's not either or. And I think another important part to recognize is that the U.S. government and the interests of the United States are necessarily separate from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is a currency that is issued functionally by the Federal Reserve that manages that. So I don't necessarily think that the interests of the Federal Reserve and the interests of the U.S. government are one and the same. I think they're different. Okay.
All right. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, you brought up Social Security. A lot of people think that's almost, you know, one of the biggest, if not the biggest Ponzi scheme that there is, but
it is a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, we're all, I mean, I'm 30 years old. I don't really anticipate Social Security to be around when I'm, you know, at the retiree age. But on top of that note, you mentioned potentially converting that to Bitcoin. Now, a lot of things in the US, like policymakers, you know, the Trump presidency that's coming in seems to be moving fast and quickly towards Bitcoin, where, you know, Trump made an appearance at the Bitcoin conference in May, or was it July? I think it was in July.
Yeah. The next one.
Yeah, exactly. So in July, and then now all of a sudden he's talking about potentially, you know, getting rid of capital gains and everything like that. So with as quickly as things are moving, do you think that's a real possibility in this next 4 years where we start to move into, you know, Social Security funds potentially holding Bitcoin?
Are you looking for the best way to store your seed phrase? Well, I've got it for you. It's Stampseed. They've got the number one punch place where you can order a full-on packet where they've got every single thing. They've got all the letters. You could just get it in there. And they've got this sick, sick hammer, which they've engineered to make it so easy for you to punch in that titanium steel plate and store your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. So go ahead and get your Bitcoin off of these exchanges and use promo code Green Candle for 15% off. They're helping power their show. They've got the Bitcoin logo. You can punch it into your seed phrase as well if you could see it here. They've got a lot of cool stuff. And now I'm helping empower you to get your Bitcoin off an exchange utilizing Stampseed and storing your seed phrase in the most secure way possible. Now get to it. All right, back to the.
I think while it's moving in that direction, there will be a lot of opposition to it. I think that as a middle ground where they might get to, or where might be realistic to expect them to get to on the strategic reserve, would be to formalize or codify that what the U.S. government currently holds will be shifted to a strategic reserve and won't be sold. And that I believe Senator Lummis's bill calls for basically there's a protection to not incentivize the U.S. government to seize Bitcoin and then turn it into its own. There's some question as to, you know, whether all of the Bitcoin that the U.S. government holds, it's actually entitled to, and that there aren't claims to it. Some, you know, example of the Bitfinex hack.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to create an incentive for the U.S. government to unlawfully seize what is private entity's property. But I could still see, regardless, that, you know, my understanding is from reading it, I don't believe it's changed, is that Senator Lummis's bill basically says that the lawful seizure those funds, and that if there are funds that are subject to other parties' claims, that they wouldn't be part of that. And I think that is realistic. I find it harder to imagine that in the next 4 years, the U.S. government greenlights, that there's sufficient consensus to greenlight actually purchasing more. You know, I think that the Overton window will have shifted if they just convert what's currently held as a permanent long-term treasury strategic reserve. And then I could see, you know, President Trump or President-elect Trump came out and talked about how Bitcoin's money and that it shouldn't be, when people spend it, it shouldn't be taxed. I could also see that getting done. Mm-hmm. Find it harder to see specifically green lighting the, and we're going to go buy more. I mean, it would be, I think it would be in the American people's interest, in the US government's interest to do that. I just believe that it might be hard to find that consensus. I'm hopeful for it, but I think that it doesn't have to be all or nothing.
Okay.
It could be converting the current reserve or current holdings to a reserve, and then other marginal steps like eliminating tax when Bitcoin is used to spend on goods and services.
Okay, so baby steps. Baby steps. Baby steps, one at a time. Okay. I mean, I could see that as well, because I do think that there's going to be a big opposition for it, at least, you know, potentially initially. But, you know, part of what Senator Lummis has proposed is selling off gold to buy more Bitcoin. So you think that would be kind of, I guess, almost a hard sell in this next 4 years?
I think when framed that way, it has a better chance of happening.
Okay.
I still view it as being a significant uphill battle, because it's essentially still the U.S. government buying Bitcoin, selling one asset to purchase another. And I would expect that it might be better received if, you know, like one example might be if Trump puts tariffs on of converting tariff dollars to Bitcoin that then go into the strategic reserve, as an example, where all the parties could reasonably get comfortable that, you know, there's a strategic reserve and China's paying for it. You know, that becomes more palatable to sell to other constituents within U.S. Congress that would need to get on board to approve it.
Okay.
So it's not to say that it's zero chance. I just think it's an uphill battle. And I think that rather than divest one asset and buy another, that it might be more likely that funds that are raised from outside interests via tariffs might be a funding mechanism to incrementally add or to collect taxes in Bitcoin and then hold whatever is collected there.
Okay. Well, yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. So with Bitcoin as well, like potential strategic reserve, do you think that, I mean, you had a great talk, I watched it the other day, like to some congressman, I believe in Dallas, where your title of the talk was Inflation is Not a Hedge, or Bitcoin is Not an Inflation Hedge, but it's the solution to inflation. I botched the title, so I apologize. But, you know, do you still see that as the way, and the strategic reserve is essentially the first step towards that? Or do you think it's more of, you know, we need to start denominating in sats opposed to dollars and cents?
No, I think that, so the talk that I gave was not to congressmen. It was a talk to family offices and high net worth individuals.
Seemed very formal. It almost was like in a courthouse.
It was actually held at Old Parkland, which was, it is now a business park, principally family offices, that is owned, operated by the Crow family.
Okay.
And the part of history of Old Parkland is it was the Parkland Hospital, which is where they took JFK after he was shot in Dealey Plaza. No longer a hospital now. It's a business park, beautiful campus, and they have a debate, what do they call it? Not debate stage, but debate chamber.
Okay.
So it's host to a number of speakers that give talks built to facilitate, you know, debate between multiple people. That night it wasn't a debate, but the name of the presentation was Bitcoin is Not a Hedge. And the idea is that you cannot, it's very different to be a hedge to inflation versus it is to be the solution to inflation. And various different assets that are correlated to the dollar are naturally a more effective hedge against dollar inflation. Bitcoin's the one asset that is uncorrelated because it's actually intending to solve the problem of money. And that, in my view, it will ultimately, in the end, replace the dollar as money. And that if you don't understand Bitcoin, you can't use it as a hedge, because the volatility will destroy you. Mm-hmm. But as your mind starts to unlock to Bitcoin and start to understand its basis as money, the importance and relevance of its fixed supply, how it's able to be enforced without the need of trust, that it is credible. As you shift down that knowledge curve, it becomes apparent that it's a lot more than a hedge and that it is the solution to inflation. So the basis of the talk was basically saying that it's not wherever you exist. If you have very limited knowledge of Bitcoin and you think that it's a hedge, Bitcoin goes up and down. You'll either sell it when it goes up or sell it when it goes down. It won't effectively store value for you because of your limited knowledge. And then as it clicks, again, it's not going to remain in that in-between zone long, because once Bitcoin unlocks in your mind, you naturally shift down to this path to seeing it as a lot more than that. So when I think about it relative to your question about the U.S. government and the Strategic Reserve, is that everybody exists somewhere on that curve or on that horizon of their knowledge of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an objective truth that exists in the world. Either Bitcoin can enforce its fixed supply or it cannot. If it can, then it will be adopted virtually by everyone as money. And in the end, it will become the predominant medium of exchange and the predominant or in the unit of account. That will happen very organically as more people figure out Bitcoin. So I think that the U.S. government creating a strategic reserve is just one more data point to people's understanding of Bitcoin and a very large entity being the U.S. government's directional understanding of it. I don't think that President Trump fully understands Bitcoin, but he's shifted in a very positive direction from where he was 5 or 6 years ago, and that's a positive. But that, you know, it's going to take more than just that to cause a broad consensus of people to realize that Bitcoin is the de facto money going forward and that they need to have it in order to get the goods and services that they need in the future.
Yeah. I think it is interesting to see Trump's kind of switch on Bitcoin, but the one unique thing about it is that he, from the beginning, he said he saw Bitcoin as an attack on the dollar and a currency, or as a currency. Now, do you still see it that way, or is it more of, because it's freedom technology and that's basically the roots of what, you know, America was built on, it's almost, you know, just coinciding with the beliefs of the American people, and holding Bitcoin might be one of the more American things you could do.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
And so I do think that that is something that people oftentimes miss. They believe that the dollar, which is a liability of the central bank, the Fed, and minted by the central bank, you know, only the Fed can create dollars. The Treasury can print dollars, but the Fed's the one that actually creates dollars. And yeah, it is a private entity, might have a quasi-public relationship, but it is a privately chartered bank, and it is the issue of currency, and it is owned by banks like JP Morgan and Bank of America and a number of other banks. So, but it is a liability of a central bank, and it is, the dollar is an inanimate object, and the US government owes debt denominated in dollars, but the US government is not the dollar.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really important to distinguish those two things, because Bitcoin, in my view, is in the interest of the U.S. government while it is competing with the dollar, and that's perfectly fine.
Okay. Now, with on top of that, right, I mean, there's a lot of, I guess, publicity is a good word for it around the Doge, right? The Department of Government Efficiency, getting Elon and Vivek Ramaswamy onto, you know, that part of the government, that, you know, I guess, newly created entity. So with that, do you think that there's a possibility that we could see the Fed either coming to a close here in the next 4 years or even in our lifetime?
I don't think that the Fed will ever be ended by fiat. I think it will be outcompeted by Bitcoin. And once it is apparent that it has been outcompeted by Bitcoin on the free market by the choice of the American people, that then there will be some formal conversation as to the efficacy of a central bank, because a central bank is not necessarily incompatible with Bitcoin. What's incompatible with Bitcoin is the ability to print money out of thin air. So if Congress that's elected by the American people decided that the Fed should continue to exist, even in a post-Bitcoin world where Bitcoin is the standard money, that Congress and by way of it, the American people could decide to capitalize a central bank with Bitcoin, they would just have to do that with real resources. And that from that point forward, the central bank could act as a lender of last resort. But if it lost the capital, the only way to replenish the capital would be through taxation or through some direct funding rather than literally clicking a button on a computer screen, which is what the central bank does now to create more money.
Yeah. So Javier Milei, you know, famously ran that he wanted to end, you know, Argentina's central bank. And it seems like Argentina is taking a turn for the better. Obviously Bukele and El Salvador has seemingly turned El Salvador around. And it seems like they're all kind of running on these, I guess like more hard money principles and, you know, kind of being aligned into Bitcoin's ethos. So how much impact do you think that those two individuals have in, you know, what they've been able to do on almost like turning the world on its head as to what everybody's been, I guess, in a sense fed this entire time, whether it's like, you know, inflation is good, all these like kind of, you know, just mantras that we're just fed from a young age.
I think both the evolving case studies of Bukele in El Salvador and Milei in Argentina are both very positive, because they're in different ways, I'd say, reintroducing accountability of government, of the function of government, and both getting away from unfunded, reckless spending of the government. But while that's true, Bukele is the one who's actually leaned into Bitcoin, recognizing it as part of the solution. And while my understanding is that Argentina might have passed a law that I'm not sure that it was actually signed into law, but it was discussed of saying that contracts could be denominated in Bitcoin. I'm not somebody that says that you have to make Bitcoin legal tender, but when Milei in Argentina basically said, you know, we're going to close our central bank, it was with the mind of increasingly dollarizing. Which, if you actually understand the problem, is a little bit of a head scratcher, because you're effectively just replacing one central bank from another and externalizing your central bank, or basically importing your central bank rather than controlling it, which is curious to me. I think that that is a short-sighted solution to a much larger problem. And so, in my view, again, it's not looking for someone like Milei to say, oh, Bitcoin is legal tender, but just saying that, well, Bitcoin is the ultimate solution to this, not the US dollar. Because why would we just trade one central bank from the other? Why would we trade one entity that has the ability to print money and export it to us with another entity that has the ability to print money and export it to us? So I think that there's some gap there. Now, obviously, Milei has put forward some strong measures of austerity to get control of federal spending, which is positive and limiting the role of government, money is the foundation of an economic system. So until they solve that problem or start to realize that Bitcoin is a big part of the solution, I feel like they're still behind the curve, but they're maybe at least ahead of everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Milei, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but my understanding, like, he is kind of getting there on the Bitcoin standard. But, you know, Argentina had significant inflation, so it was, I guess, like a step towards Bitcoin, and the middle step was dollarization. Then they'll move towards that. But I mean, I guess time will tell on that. The other thing I wanted to dive into you with is, you know, outside of just like different nation states adopting it, Dennis Porter is tweeting out a lot that it's a state's race to put it on the state's balance sheet, or use Bitcoin as a strategic reserve for state's balance sheets. How much weight do you take in, I guess, that, where maybe, you know, individual states will start to do it before, you know, the U.S. government utilizing Bitcoin as a strategic reserve?
Yeah, I do think that, well, again, where I would come down on is that maybe the federal government gets there faster of formalizing what it currently holds as a strategic reserve. But I do think that state governments are smaller, nimbler,
more agile,
and should be able to move faster. And they're not issuers of their own currency, even though technically the U.S. government does not issue the currency, the Fed does.
Yeah.
I don't know if the proper term of the role is CFO, but the treasurer, senior official that manages finances for the state of Florida, basically came out and said,
Yeah,
we're looking at holding Bitcoin. I think all states should be holding Bitcoin. And there's just states that are probably more aligned with less internal conflict in terms of alignment around needing to create a solution for inflation that's created by the printing of dollars. So it does make sense that states would be able to move faster. What I would say, though, is that I would pay attention to what the states say, not, you know, these breaking news of someone putting together a Bitcoin bill that doesn't say Bitcoin.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't say that we're going to take a forward action to protect ourselves specifically in Bitcoin. Oftentimes these bills say digital assets, this and this, and then someone puts it on Twitter and say that this is a Bitcoin bill.
Yeah.
So until a state, like the state treasurer or whoever that was from Florida, CFO, treasurer,
yeah.
I don't even know if there's a CFO, but he specifically said Bitcoin. That signals somebody actually understands it. So long as the state legislature is talking about digital assets or cryptocurrencies, that is your clear sign that they do not understand Bitcoin. So I would not put weight, but like somebody can't not make a credible argument for Bitcoin of why a state should hold it if they're still saying digital assets. So discount anybody's intent if you hear that.
Yeah, it's almost like a marketing ploy for.
It's just like they're not going to be a credible salesperson to the rest of the people that they need to convince to form a consensus to take an action, right? It's like, we know for certain, if you're still saying digital assets or crypto, you do not get Bitcoin. So if you don't get Bitcoin and then you're sitting down trying to talk to other colleagues in a state house, like state senators or congressmen or a governor,
sale on it.
Like try to make a sale for Bitcoin if you don't understand it. Can't.
Yeah, no, that's plain and simple there. And I agree with you on that as well. So, I mean, I just think it's going to be interesting, especially with the way that the price is ripping here, that we're going to see more and more attention around Bitcoin and legislators are going to try to come around. Obviously, with Trump coming to the Bitcoin conference, as we alluded to earlier, there's just a lot more, I guess, like eyeballs on the Bitcoin ecosystem now than I think there was 4 years ago, even 2 years ago when, you know, a lot of these, you know, Senate elections were going around. So, you know, how big of a role do you think that the price action that we've seen just now, I guess, plays a role in it? And do you think we're even close to done with this this run up here?
So what I'd say is price, any price, is information. So the price of Bitcoin going up, even if people are not interpreting it consciously this way, is a signal to buy Bitcoin. So in that way, FOMO, even if you don't understand why, is rational, because there's a truth in the signal of the information that is being sent to people when the price of Bitcoin is nearly 100,000. A couple things click for people, which is Bitcoin didn't die. So it's still around. I thought it was going away. It never goes away. It just keeps getting higher. If you were somebody that was paying attention to Bitcoin when it was at 65,000 in 2021, and then it went down to 16,000, you said, nah, I was right not to jump in that. Now you're having the exact, some information is being sent to you via the price that says, maybe I was wrong. Bitcoin didn't die and it's still here. Maybe I need to get some just in case it takes off. And so the price is relevant. But price is an output of more and more people evaluating Bitcoin, not from a FOMO perspective, but from a rational perspective to say, do I want to hold this as an asset? Does it have properties that will allow it to store value? Again, people can be in different positions. Like, two things can be true at the same time. People can be finding Bitcoin for the true signal being the credibility of its fixed supply, while at the same time, people are speculating in it without understanding it. But for the market to move higher, to find equilibrium above $1 trillion and now being worth close to $2 trillion in a volatile state, it's difficult to know whether there's equilibrium here, if it will continue to go higher, or where it will find that next point of equilibrium where it really does price discovery for a long time at. But it is relevant, and you know, a $2 trillion asset versus a couple hundred billion dollar asset becomes harder for more people to deny. It necessarily attracts more people's attention, right? When Bitcoin crashes to 16,000, it's off of TV. This morning, there's an interview with Andrew Hans from New Market Capital, and then Saylor right after him. 10 minutes and 10 minutes of just straight Bitcoin talk on CNBC. So people follow the signal that is sent by the information of price and will continue to do. And so it's impossible to know whether it continues to rise. I feel like, you know, my sense is that there's a lot more people to be dragged in because of what's happened. But what's happened was a function of all the infrastructure that was built over the last 4 years, all the people doing hard research and understanding, and the ETFs getting created, and entities like the Wisconsin State Board deciding to buy Bitcoin, and, you know, people all over the world doing the work to figure it out to then send that signal of price to everybody else. So I think that it continues to run and go higher, and that, you know, people typically, human psychology, you know, if you go sit down and talk to your, you know, 10 family members at Thanksgiving, everyone's going to be doing that. And historically, generally, Bitcoin hasn't moved in doubles. It's moved in orders of magnitude or 5 to 10x. So hard to see that this is it, but the price is relevant and we'll find an equilibrium, and there'll probably be some unsustainable blow off top that will then set a correction, but doesn't feel like it's here.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't feel like it's here either. But do you still think that, you know, I mean, we alluded to it a little bit at the beginning, but the suddenly, that almost implies, like, you know, the super cycle, so to speak, where we're never going to kind of go through this business cycle waves. Is that kind of how I like to view it, opposed to the halving cycle? Do you think eventually we get to that point? I'm not saying that this is necessarily it here, but eventually, you know, we get away from these 4 year cycles that we see, and we just, you know, almost continue to go up.
Well, eventually there will be a last cycle, and it will be when Bitcoin rapidly monetizes and becomes, everything becomes priced in Bitcoin. And that will probably play out over a year or two. I have no idea whether this is the last cycle.
Yeah.
You know, I tend to doubt that it is because of how few people understand it. And even at $2 trillion, if the global financial system is $400 trillion, it is less than 1%. You know, it's a half of a percent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say that a consensus will be formed. Also, whether it's having cycles, I think that it's actually human psychology. It is FOMO. Like, FOMO is a real thing, but human psychology and humans acting in herds, which is you have friend circles and family circles and spheres of influences. And so if people are recognizing that Bitcoin is a viable medium, that they do though, they come to that conclusion in herds. So if less than one out of 10, sorry, if less than one out of 100 people understand Bitcoin, then an increase of 10 times would only represent 10%. And if there's this FOMO where like 10x the number of people rush in, those 10x number of people do not understand Bitcoin. They're FOMOing in and they're afraid of missing it. And so they force the price up to such a level that it can't actually sustain that level, and then it gets sold. And that's what causes the correction cycle. So very difficult to believe that we're out of cycles at this point because of human psychology, because of the real, tangible, actually productive FOMO, and then the outpacing the liquidity that's formed to then correct and then to set anew. And the fact that there's a supply shock every 4 years, like, that's a real thing. And that creates marginal scarcity. So to deny it kind of seems illogical to me.
Calling all shadowy supercoders. I've got an event specifically for you. That's right. I am working with PlebLab to help out with Top Builder. Top Builder, it's like the Top Chef, but for shadowy supercoders. They've got a Bitcoin prize worth of $15,000 that you can earn when you showing off your skills. But not only that, you will gain valuable exposure, mentorship, and great collaboration opportunities. And a lot of people raised money last year, not just the winner. So you have the potential to show your stuff. All you got to do is sign up now. Between now and December 31st, go through 3 rounds where you are showing your skills. And then at the end, you will showcase your stuff at Startup Day down in Austin. So go ahead and sign up now and get everything started for Top Builder and showcase your stuff and help build in the Bitcoin ecosystem. All right, enough for me, back to the show.
But with that, so that I'm teetering on this idea here with the supply shock, like, right? It's like 92 or 93% of the total Bitcoin supply has already been mined. So would the supply shock of, you know, 7 to 8% really send it and, you know, make that drastic of a difference?
The rate of issuance cutting in half, I mean, like, one way I think about it is that at the 2020 halving,
mm-hmm.
the market was absorbing in new supply approximately 6,000 or 7,000 times 12.5 Bitcoin at any point in time. And then at the point of the last halving, we were like 60,000 at 6.125 Bitcoin, dropping down to 3.125. So the liquidity that the market was absorbing 4 years later was greater than the liquidity that it was absorbing at the halving prior to it.
Yeah.
So at any point in time, generally because Bitcoin is growing, the market is absorbing more liquidity that's coming online because the real purchasing power of Bitcoin is going up faster than the rate of issuance being cut in half. So if the market was absorbing, say, I don't know what the actual number was, but something like $60 million a day, like, I'm too tired to do the math right now, but just say as an example, I believe when I did the math a year or two or a year ago before the halving, that was what the number was. Maybe it was different at the point of the halving, but $30 million of every single day flow is significant to the market to suddenly disappear. And in order to satisfy that nominal supply, people have to bid the price up to induce the current holders to meet the demand rather than the new supply. So
it's almost a combination of the holders and the miners kind of are needing to meet
supply.
Okay.
Or the demand.
Yeah.
Needing to provide the supply to meet the increasing demand.
Okay. That's more eloquently put then, because I can get on board with that, because the way I kind of viewed it was, you know, there's such little supply being issued, but I think it's more on like the user behavior, maybe just not willing to sell until it continues to run up. And that's what's going to happen over time, is that the
just think about it, like on any given day, the existing holders are selling some amount. And there's some average, and price moving up impacts that, and price moving down moves that, essentially in counterbalancing ways. So there's some average. Like if you look at the HODL waves, there's some amount that's moving every day.
Yeah.
And it's variable, but there's a baseline. And so there can be idiosyncratic things that cause the existing holders of Bitcoin to sell a larger volume that is detached from the halving or the price. An example of that would be the German government selling 50,000 Bitcoin. That is supply to the market needs to absorb. That is in certain ways a one-off.
Mm-hmm.
Not every day does a government show up with 50,000 Bitcoin to sell. But if you do the math on it, right now, if approximately 450 Bitcoin are mined each day, and not all of that's being sold, but let's just use it as an example, that's the right number, right? 450 Bitcoin a day.
Yeah.
So 50,000 is like 60 days worth of new supply. Like that is an example of more supply coming on from existing holders. So it's not an argument against the impact of the halving. It's just saying that the supply has to come from somewhere. And if the rate of issuance, which is a natural sell pressure, given the function of mining needing to consume energy and pay for energy, then the supply, if the issuance gets cut in half, it has to come from holders of the currency. In order, because nothing about that event changes the demand, current demand and trajectory of demand. In order to be satisfied, typically over time, as we've seen, you got to bid the price up to get Bitcoiners to part with some small percentage of their holdings. Yeah.
Okay. Understood. All right. So then, you know, then we get to towards a potentially hyper Bitcoinized world where everything is transacting in Bitcoin, right? I think that's, as Bitcoiners, that's kind of like the end all be all. But how do you see us getting to that world? Because I see essentially like two scenarios. Where one, the US dollar or whatever is a global reserve currency at the time gets hyperinflated away. And then maybe we have a decade plus of just pain where we have to rebuild it back. And then Bitcoin's kind of the savior that comes in. But even at the beginning, unless you have, you know, a great community, it's going to be kind of tough to find, you know, your local eggs, all these kind of things. It's going to be a little bit of chaos. The other scenario is, you know, maybe it's delayed 50, 60 years down the road where we get to a hyper Bitcoinized world. And, you know, we kind of have these micro communities that are popping up utilizing Bitcoin in circular economies. And then that allows the builders to help for scaling and all this other kind of stuff. But eventually we get there because the amount of communities that are popping up that are utilizing Bitcoin is just too much to deny. So then eventually we get to that point. How do you see it playing out? Is it either one of those scenarios, or do you think there's another way that I just haven't thought of yet?
I think it's the first scenario, that the world is figuring out Bitcoin, and that while it's still a small percentage of the global financial system, it call it 0.5%, that large, powerful interests and small guerrilla effects are both taking hold at the same time. We're 15 or 16 years into Bitcoin. Bitcoin is working. It's enforcing its fixed supply that only gets more secure as the Bitcoin network grows, as more people adopt it, as the mining infrastructure becomes more robust. And so it's difficult to see how, say, demand for Bitcoin doesn't increase by 10 times over the next 4 or 5 years and 100 times over the next decade. Well, if Bitcoin increased by, if it's approximately $2 trillion today in total purchasing power in dollar terms, and that has a certain purchasing power based on dollars, the dollar economy today, if Bitcoin was to increase 100 times in dollar terms, it would dwarf, the global Bitcoin economy would dwarf the dollar economy in terms of the money supply. So in that world, when Bitcoin becomes the biggest, everything becomes relatively volatile and Bitcoin becomes the thing that's stable. Along that time horizon is where I view Bitcoin rapidly monetizing when it becomes obvious to people. And that when fiat currencies are not hyperinflating because Bitcoin exists. Fiat currencies are hyperinflating because they're failing to coordinate economic activity because they've been printed for so long that those economies that they've supported, whether it's the US, Europe, China, Japan, wherever you might be, Russia, those economies have fractured and become very fragile because of the printing of money and because of having bad money for so long. They're failing on their own accord. And Bitcoin was introduced as a solution, recognizing this is a problem. And now that it's actually gaining steam and it's working so well, the two things are related. They're the other side of the same coin. If you have a credit system in the US that's $100 trillion, if you have a global debt system that's $300 trillion-ish, and those assets functionally become worthless because the currency that they're denominating in get deteriorates in value so quickly, someone's holding those assets. Some pension fund's holding the assets. Some mom and pop are holding those assets that there's no way to go to this world of excess and this highly fragile economic system built on fiat to a sound monetary standard without taking some pain.
Mm-hmm.
It's unrealistic to think that. That doesn't mean that, or what I would say is that because Bitcoin exists, the pain that will be felt will be far less than if it didn't exist. Thinking about an example of an economy like Lebanon's or Argentina's or Venezuela, when a currency hyperinflates, everyone just flocks into the other currency, and the relative comfort of economic stability might deteriorate, but humans are resilient, incredibly resilient. They find a way to survive. And when you have this form of money that's finite for everyone to adopt, then the pain is going to be less than the scenario where it didn't exist. So it's like, yes, like we can't shift off this highly debt-driven, imbalanced world of fiat currencies onto a sound money standard without some pain, but we're going to be okay at the same time because the good money exists. And so whether it's pain for a decade or whether it's pain for a few years, that Bitcoin's going to get distributed the way that most people are probably going to lose their Bitcoin is in this time. Like they're going to have to spend their Bitcoin to get things like eggs. And that'll be a good thing. That'll be how Bitcoin gets distributed in a very balanced way. And a little bit of pain isn't a bad thing if it means solving the problem permanently so that then the trajectory can be marginally better and better.
Yeah, onwards and upwards, right? But you mentioned, you know, getting Bitcoin for eggs and all that as part of the scenario I use. But, you know, you're working at Zap right now, which is helping with invoicing, you know, transacting peer-to-peer with Bitcoin, also, you know, incorporating fiat rails. But, you know, how have you guys seen the development of, you know, everything at Zap, right? More users coming on and obviously, you know, the big publicity you guys got helping President Trump buy some burgers at PubKey. Like, how big do you think that this is going to, I guess, like pop off the top here in this next, I guess, this cycle where more and more people could potentially start, I guess, transacting in Bitcoin.
Are you looking for a way to earn some free sats? Who isn't? Well, I've got the perfect way for you. It's an app called Yopaki. Besides having the absolute coolest name in the game, they've got an interactive card game called Lotteria. Oh, look at that accent. I'm just hitting it, huh? That can teach you the history of Bitcoin and financial literacy. They've got amazing services and one of the slickest mobile wallets. Download it now using this link and you can get 500 sats on the house on Green Candle, and then you can play Lotteria every single day in order to potentially get some sats. All you got to do is match the cards, and it's an extremely fun and interactive way to learn more about Bitcoin. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show.
Generally, I think that it is an order of operations. Someone first has to understand Bitcoin for them to credibly want to accept Bitcoin as payment. There are people that don't have to understand Bitcoin that can think they want to accept Bitcoin as payment, but ultimately, I view that to be unsustainable because they won't understand the why behind what they're doing. They've been told something and it sounds good, so they do it, but they can't actually think from first principles themselves. That being said, that in an adoption wave of Bitcoin, more people do come to understand it, whether that's 2 times the number of people, 3 times the number of people, 4 times the number of people. And that the natural consequence of more people understanding Bitcoin is more people demanding it as payment. So we're still very early in Bitcoin payments. We're building the tools. The tools are getting better. More people that I would say operate a business for which Bitcoin is not core. Like they're not running Bitcoin meetups, or they're not hosting a Bitcoin conference, or they're not running a business for Bitcoin exchange or custody or Bitcoin payments, whatever it might, or Bitcoin education, whatever it might be, or a podcast. There are more businesses that are not one of those, that are just a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, a small grocer, a rancher. More people like that that are starting to understand Bitcoin, that are demanding Bitcoin as payment. And so that's a very good sign. You need business owners that understand Bitcoin to demand it. I view that as the, and that's what we're seeing consistently, that it's the business owner understanding Bitcoin that wants it for their business to say, pay me in Bitcoin, rather than the consumer-driven side. And imagine that world of business owners that go from a certain base of them that understand it to 5x the number. That only causes the trend to accelerate. It results in more people demanding the services that then make the tools better, that then deliver more capital to then carry on with the pro-cyclical improvement of the actual ecosystem. So that's happening today. We're seeing, again, very early, but we're seeing very positive growth and trajectory and the right type of businesses coming in. And we, not to say that somebody that's business is centered around Bitcoin is the wrong type of business. It's just a signal when somebody has a business that is otherwise unrelated to Bitcoin that is also wanting to adopt it. And we're seeing those type of businesses and the size of those businesses, the more complicated ones, starting to say, hey, I want to explore this.
Yeah. And it seems like maybe that's more towards, I guess the proper way to run a business. Cause I mean, we've seen some kind of crazy times here in the decade from 2010 to 2020, where a lot of businesses popped up and almost tried to do like the Amazon model, where they would either, have a bunch of money backing them, not worry about cash flow for a long time, and then thinking they'll figure it out. I mean, like Uber's a great example. They haven't made any money the entire time of their existence. I mean, obviously a lot of the things that you guys are working with on a smaller scale, but do you think we're reverting a little bit towards that, where cash flow and like actually making a profit is not just like a novel concept, it's like actually what businesses are starting to be centered around?
Absolutely. I think that not to prescribe anything for everyone, but I do think that if you start from the perspective of everything begins fundamentally from an understanding of Bitcoin, that once that unlocks for you this idea that there is a finite amount of money and that no more can be created, no more can be printed, that once you understand that as an individual, you start to be minded towards increasing your surplus, consuming less than you produce, producing for others more than you consume from them on a personal level. And then naturally, the people that understand Bitcoin are going to be the ones building infrastructure for Bitcoin. That extends to the businesses that are building infrastructure for Bitcoin, because they're operated by people that understand Bitcoin. Again, mm-hmm. it's not to say every business or to every individual, but on average, it is shifting that way, where everyone is far more conscious of the cost of capital, the benchmark being Bitcoin, the idea that if I'm going to be in this business and spending my time doing this, say building Zaprite, I need to be able to earn more Bitcoin than doing something else. And that starts with that business needs to generate capital on its own, not relying on outside parties. And so increasingly, yes, it is minded earlier in the cycle of business, say, okay, how do we get this business to be cash flow positive such that we can stack Bitcoin? And a lot of that might be, rather than raising a bunch of outside capital to essentially mortgage your future, it is focusing on where are the revenue opportunities today? Can I grow organically? Can I minimize my expense base to be okay not having to, quote, chase growth or manufacture growth, but focusing on that sustainability of the market and growing with the market? And basically saying, I'm okay with the market for Bitcoin payments being small today because it's growing faster than any other market. And how can I get to that point of profitability fastest, sharpening the perspective of what you build and how you monetize?
Okay, great. Well, let's get into some more, I guess, like personal questions here, so people can get to know the real Parker Lewis. So you went to Duke. What years did you go to Duke again?
I graduated in 2006.
Okay, so sorry to date you a little bit, but I believe those are the J.J. Redick years. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so do you think J.J. Redick, for those who don't know, long illustrious career in the NBA, now current head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, do you think he made more at Duke or his time in the NBA?
Oh,
I'm joking. I'm giving you a hard time here, but
you know, well, made more.
This is pre NIL, right?
Yeah, so. Pre NIL. And I, you know, Duke ran a clean program. You know, maybe there was some money on the table, but certainly not more than football programs.
Yeah.
So I'd say yeah, but true. That it was the J.J. Redick years. We didn't win a national title while I was there, but.
Yeah, was it like the year before the, like 2001 maybe, that they won a national championship?
Yeah, so yeah. Again, maybe a year before. It was 2001. I have gotten to go see Duke win in person two national championships.
There we go.
Both in Indianapolis, 2010 against Butler, and then 2015 against Wisconsin.
Ooh, the Butler one, right? That was the Gordon Hayward, like, half-court shot.
Almost went in.
Yeah,
man.
That was sure your heart was racing. Banked
off the... The glass, off the rim, off the glass, and then out.
Yeah, that was crazy. Then, I guess, overall, how bad do you miss Coach K?
I don't really miss Coach K. I have great appreciation for him.
It's
great to watch Duke basketball. He's the GOAT as it relates to college basketball. But I like the fact that he, you know, left before it was, you know, clear that, you know, it's kind of, I won't say left in his prime, but like last year he was there, they lost in the Final Four, unfortunately, to UNC. But
how bad did that hurt?
Yeah, you know,
yeah,
it was good. Like he made a run to the
Final Four.
So the fact that he kind of, you know, it's like John Elway when John Elway won back to back Super Bowls and then left, you know, like hard to replicate that. But I think it was a good thing that, you know, Coach K was still getting to the Final Four when he was leaving the program in good shape.
I gotcha. So because Michael Jordan is a Tar Heel, is he not the GOAT, or do you think he is?
Oh, no, Jordan's definitely the GOAT.
All right, cool. At least we can settle on that one. All right, but you are an Austin guy too, right?
Yeah.
So, all right. So for those visiting in Austin, where do you tell them to go right away? Whether it's food or places, what's the top thing that they have to see? You're in Austin for 10 hours, say.
Well, also to date me, growing up, when I was in seventh grade, Drew Brees was in high school.
Yeah, Westlake.
Won a state championship that year. So just kind of like when it comes to the sports lore, big fan of Drew Brees. But let's see, what do I tell people to do in Austin? You know, the weird thing is like whenever I get that question, I think about what are the things that tourists do.
Yeah.
But I'll just talk about my favorite things about Austin. I love to get out in the hill country. So kind of the Llano, Fredericksburg,
yeah, so you Mason like to go out there,
area, huh? Enchanted Rock. Within Austin, going to Barton Springs, one of my favorite things about Austin is going to Barton Springs, walking around the lake, the trail.
Yeah, highly, Town Lake, right?
Not Town Lady, Lake, yeah, not Lady Bird. Bird. That's how you know, this is the key. That's the way that you know that people are not from here is if they call it Lady Bird.
Yep, exactly.
If they're from here, they call it Town Lake. There's a lot of other things like Manchac, Guadalupe, all the words that people that are from Austin mispronounce.
Yeah.
Burn it. There's a lot of those, but yeah, so go to walk the Town Lake, go to Barton Springs. Austin's a very outdoor city, so get outdoors. Go to the Texas History Museum. That's cool.
Okay, so one has to go, Texas barbecue or tacos that we have famously here, because everybody always hits me up and says Austin's like, you know, there's all these videos, Austin's the taco capital of the world, because you throw anything in a tortilla down here, we're calling it a taco. So one has to go. Which one do you think is better?
Well, I wouldn't say better or worse, but I say eat carnivore more. I would go the barbecue route.
There we go.
I also love brisket. The my local place that I go for Mexican food is Mahdi's.
Shout out
Mahdi's. I don't know if it's the, you know, quote unquote best, but
I like Mahdi's.
Yeah.
Mahdi's is a good, always a good, safe choice.
Yeah. Mahdi's or Matt's.
Okay, Matt's. I haven't heard of that one just yet, so I'll have to try.
Matt's is definitely the probably most famous. Matt's famous El Rancho.
Okay. And then, so you grew up here. What is like the most drastic change that you've noticed to the city of Austin throughout your time here?
Just the skyline.
Skyline?
Yeah.
Just more and more things popping up?
Yeah, the skyline, it's definitely more of an urban city. Downtown used to be super sleepy. No one lived down here.
Yeah.
Well, it was the capital. It was kind of a quiet college town.
There we go.
Now it's more of an urban center, but I don't feel like that's really changed the culture of Austin.
Okay, so then how big is the Bitcoin, I guess, center here? Are you going to go out on a limb and say Austin's the Bitcoin capital of the world?
What I would say is that, you know, Texas is the center of hash, and Austin's the center of Texas, and with all the Bitcoiners that are here, young and old, you know, actively developing or not, it's hard to say that anywhere else would be the capital. You know, it would be hard to make the argument somewhere else where, you know, but every city is going to be a Bitcoin city. So love going to Nashville for a few days here and there and, you know, visiting friends, you know, wherever they might be. Went to BTC Prague over the summer. That was phenomenal. Great Bitcoiners there. So there's great Bitcoiners in a lot of places. You know, I'll always call Austin home, and you know, not leaving the Texas Hill Country, but it's not for everybody.
Yeah, I gotcha. All right. Well, you're also a recent father. You told me 3 weeks now, right? Is that correct? So what is the number one thing you're looking forward to in fatherhood?
I don't know. Just raising a good son. You know, high character.
There you go.
Raise a good Bitcoiner.
Yeah. Breeding more Bitcoiners. All right. Well, Parker, you've been very generous with your time, so I appreciate you coming in. Why don't you tell everybody where they can find out more about you and Zaprite?
Yeah. So if you're interested in accepting Bitcoin as payment, one, I would say if you understand Bitcoin, understand why it stores value, and you run a business or you are a person that is influential in a business that can influence those type of decisions, then you should be seriously thinking about accepting Bitcoin as payment. If you do not yet understand Bitcoin or why it stores value, I highly encourage you to read a book like The Bitcoin Standard or grabbing my book, Gradually Then Suddenly, and in starting there, that it is an order of operations. But if you are one of those people that are further down the curve that are already understanding it, and you are a key role in a business or a business owner, it is incumbent upon you, I'd say, for the interest of your business, for the security of your business, to be investing in infrastructure to accept it. In that case, definitely look us up at Zaprite, zaprite.com, Z-A-P-R-I-T-E.com. Reach out to us. I'll help you personally. I think it's, you know, an important thing to do for businesses broadly, and we're helping to accelerate that shift toward a Bitcoin standard from the payment side. So look us up at zaprite.com. You can follow us on X, Twitter, Zaprite at Zaprite app. You can follow me personally, Parker A. Lewis. And then I write from time to time, in addition to having my book on my blog, which is gradually then suddenly.xyz. So reach out. We're excited about what we're building at Zaprite, and we're excited to help you if you're interested in taking that step of accepting Bitcoin as payment.
Yeah, it's very easy to use. I'll put the green candle stamp of approval. I use it to bill my sponsors now. So it's
great. Awesome. Yeah, appreciate the support.
Yeah, it's awesome stuff. So Parker, thanks so much, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Brandon.
Thank you for tuning into the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.